So I'm going to talk about processes that take place at and near the Coromandel boundary. It'll be a talk that devotes quite a bit of time to ideas. Obviously, data are very important, and at the end I will talk about how to make connections between data and the ideas that I discuss. Let's begin by asking the question, what do we care about? What processes might take place at and near the Coromandel boundary? The first and most obvious, no doubt about this one, is that there must be thermal coupling between the core and the mantle. Because the core is a low viscosity system, the outer core, and the mantle is a high viscosity system, the mantle will be the master in dictating the thermal boundary condition for the core. The core will tend to create uniform conditions horizontally, and so the mantle convection will be the master and the core will be the slave, and the heat flow from the core will be dictated by the way in which the mantle takes up that heat. And this is of importance for people who worry about dynamo modeling. And I'm not going to talk about it much, but let me point out that this is one way of understanding the character of the lowermost mantle. To the extent that dynamo theorists think that they can understand the character of the Earth's magnetic field and why it reverses and the spatial spectrum of the magnetic field, there may be information, indirect information, about the lowermost mantle through their kind of modeling. There are many different issues here that I do not have time to address concerning the extent to which dynamo theorists are actually modeling what takes place in the core. So you have to condition what I'm saying with many caveats, but it is possible that through looking at the spatial character of the magnetic field, whether some aspects of the structure varying in time or fixed with particular features in the mantle, it is possible that this might tell us something about D double prime. The other thing that is undoubtedly present, but not that well understood, is the fluid dynamical coupling, the mechanical and electromagnetic coupling between the core and the mantle. There is a variation in the rotation of the Earth, variation on many scales from days to months to years to decades to centuries to thousands of years, in which we see evidence for a coupling between the core and the mantle. Bruce Buffett, I expect, would have talked about some aspects of this last week or the week before. And on the time scale of decades, the preferred explanation for length of day variations is Coromandel coupling. The model that Bruce likes, and which may well be correct, is that one of the sources of this coupling, in particular to explain nutation studies that he worked on, is to have a layer at the base of the mantle which may not be uniform, may not be the same everywhere, but in some average sense has a conductance of 10 to the 8 Siemens. Let me remind you that in SI units, conductivity has units of Siemens per meter, so you can think of this conductance as a product of a mean conductivity times a thickness. So if you had a conductivity like the Earth's core, 10 to the 6 or so Siemens per meter, it would mean a layer of order 100 meters in thickness. But of course, you can have a thicker layer with lower conductivity. It is also thought very likely, but this is still actually quite controversial, that there's an important aspect of coupling between core and mantle that comes from pressure. And the way that pressure acts on the core-mantle boundary is through the non-sphericity of the Coromandel boundary, the topography. And so pressure talks are also probably important. and in principle contain information about the distribution of topography. I'm going to talk mainly about chemical interaction and material transport. Chemical interaction would come about through a disequilibrium at the core-mantle boundary, the delivery of material to the core-mantle boundary through mantle convection, in which that material is out of equilibrium with the core. The chemical potential of the various constituents in the mantle would be different from the corresponding constituents or elements in the core. And this may, of course, affect the core energetics through changing the gravitational energy budget of the core, and it may affect, therefore, the dynamo process. And of course, as part of this, there would be the possibility of actual transport across the core-mantle boundary. And when I say material transport, I include, of course, the possibility of erosion in the sense of dissolving material from the mantle into the core, or, in my opinion, a more likely process, which is material coming out of the core and depositing on the base of the mantle. So why do we care about this possibility of material transport? Well, one obvious possibility, of course, is that it might affect geochemical reservoirs. The core is the reservoir of last resort for the geochemists, and rightly so. There are a number of reasons for thinking that it's difficult to carry material across the core-mantle boundary, but it may not be a negligible thing for affecting the geochemical reservoirs, and I'll talk a bit about that. And of course, material transport can affect the heat transport and the mantle dynamics. Partial melting at the base of the mantle will affect the rate and the method of carrying heat through the bottommost part of the mantle. If core constituents play a role in that partial melting, as I will argue may be the case, then that's certainly something that you need to consider. And of course, the core energetics and dynamo process may be importantly affected by this, and the coupling between the core and the mantle will also be affected depending on the actual character of that interface. Some facts about the core-mantle boundary. It's not necessarily sharp. There is a thing that seismologists call the core-mantle boundary, and seismologists will give you a number for the radius of the core. And of course, that means that on a seismic wavelength, which is many kilometers, there is something that you can call the core-mantle boundary, but that doesn't mean that if you went down there that you could actually place your hand on the core-mantle boundary and say, oh yeah, you know, it's clearly the mantle above and the core below. I don't think that's, you might, well, it, you know, it's got an osmium glove on it or something, but it's not necessarily that sharp. I prefer, and this of course is a semantics argument which will arise when people talk about core rigidity zones and so forth, my personal preference is to think of the core-mantle boundary as being a rheologically defined boundary, with the stuff above being capable of supporting S waves and having some stiffness and rigidity, and the stuff below not having those properties. And so if you define it that way, the material below is mostly liquid and the material above is mostly solid, but the important thing here is the word mostly. One could, of course, have a gradational boundary. There is topography, though Thorne did not talk about the topography. I think the topography issue is important. I understand that you know, it's difficult for seismologists to pin this number down. Geodetically, there's only one harmonic that can be resolved, and it corresponds to a few hundred meters. Seismologists who have looked at this usually come up with numbers of order a few kilometers, peak to peak. And of course, the information that we have supports the idea that there's a fundamental difference in rheology over a relatively short distance of a few kilometers. And as I mentioned in connection with Bruce Buffett's work, there may be a layer right adjacent to the core-mantle boundary that has fairly high electrical conductivity, at least in some places. Now, Thorne has already talked about the relationship, the core-mantle boundary to the overlying mantle, so I'm not going to go through this general ideas about D double prime as possibly being a graveyard of slabs or repository of primordial material, which may or may not be sampled by mantle circulation or by plumes. And then, of course, Thorne also talked about the seismic characterization of D double prime and the presence of this ultra-low velocity zone. And there's the usual cartoon. Now, there are two extreme viewpoints that you can take, and it's worth keeping these in mind, even though neither of them is likely to be completely right. The truth lies somewhere in between. One extreme viewpoint is that the mantle and the core do not exchange material. You just have a thermal boundary layer to accommodate core heat. Thorne already talked about why we think that D double prime is not just a thermal boundary layer, and I agree with that. But even in this picture, where the core and the mantle do not exchange material, one could then still say, okay, D double prime is not just a thermal boundary layer. 1000 Kelvin is too much for a thermal boundary layer, and anyway, the seismic data are too complicated to be explained by a thermal boundary layer. In which case, you say the D double prime results from primordial mantle differentiation and settling of material in the mantle. It's a natural garbage dump for processes in the mantle. It's perfectly natural to have complexity at the top of a convecting system and complexity at the bottom of the system. And you don't have to have a role for the deeper layer, the core in this case, from the point of view of affecting the composition. That's one extreme point of view. The other extreme point of view is to say that the exchange of material between core and the mantle is the dominant characteristic, that it actually determines D double prime, determines many of the characteristics of the system. D double prime and the ultra low velocity zone in this picture would result from core mantle exchange. Now, some guiding principles to keep in mind as we proceed. The first is that the core and the mantle cannot reach global chemical equilibrium. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is that one could, if one were just playing a mind game, imagine that the mantle is so vigorously stirred that every little bit of the mantle has had a chance to equilibrate with the core, and as a consequence, they are indeed in chemical equilibrium, so that if you brought a parcel in the mantle right now down to the core mantle boundary, the chemical potential of each constituent in that parcel would be the same as the chemical potential of corresponding constituents in the core. That's unlikely because it's unlikely that there has been such vigorous stirring, but even if there had been, the core mantle boundary is changing its thermodynamic state through geologic time. So even if it had equilibrated 4 billion years ago, it won't be equilibrated now because the chemical potential is temperature dependent. So the system is being continuously sustained away from equilibrium, and moreover, the system is not so vigorously stirred in all likelihood anyway. On the other hand, the core and the mantle must reach local chemical equilibrium. Right at that interface, however you define it, it should indeed be the case that the chemical potentials are equal across the boundary, however you define it. And there the idea is that kinetics are not important at 4000 Kelvin for long periods of time, and so indeed thermodynamic equilibrium in the Gibbsian sense should apply. That, of course, doesn't mean that you have chemical equilibrium 1 micron away from the interface, or a kilometer away. The question of how far that local equilibrium persists depends on process. So the consequences of the equilibration may be small or large depending on the thickness of the region affected and the physical processes that you use to drive the system towards equilibration. And of course, we have to keep in mind that even if there is a locally large effect, it might not affect the surface observables, the geochemical observables, because that layer might be more dense and might be imperfectly sampled by the convective process. It may sit there, it may get moved around, it may be horizontally heterogeneous, and yet that material might be expressed only to a small extent in the stuff that gets to the reservoirs that are melted near Earth's surface. So you might not see it in the rocks. Let me talk about some of the processes that might affect this region. And the first one to point out is, of course, that an aspect of what takes place near the Coromandel boundary may be primordial in origin. We think that during the formation of the Earth, there was extensive melting. These traumatic events may have been short-lived in terms of the history of the Earth, but very important in setting up the initial condition. And in the deeper region, where you have the most crystallization in all likelihood, because the melting point has a strong pressure dependence than the adiabat, you expect that as the system goes from the liquidus through to the solidus, that there will be migration of the melt that coexists with the crystals. And so there should have been, at that point, some differentiation. And of course, we don't know the phase diagram yet. So we don't know what goes up and what goes down, and that's a crucial question for the mineral physicists. But there should be some differentiation, and the differentiation will, through the action of gravity, cause the high-density material to accumulate at the base. Now, I want to remind you, however, that the fact that heavy material sinks, one of the few things we can be sure about in this business, that doesn't mean that the system will start out with that stable stratification being impressed upon the mantle. And here I give you a counterexample just to show why that may not be so. Suppose you plot as a function of height above the Coromandel boundary the uncompressed density, which is what matters, you know, after you've taken away the effect of compression. And so it's a curve that tells you about compositional effects and about stability. Suppose that I had a phase diagram which had the property that indeed you dumped heavy material towards the base of the mantle, but you did it from some mid-mantle region, and the transition zone or some other part of the mantle did not do the same thing because it was in a different phase. Then you could get a curve that, for example, looked like this, for the uncompressed density as a function of depth. And this, of course, is Rayleigh-Taylor unstable. It will tend to mix this part with this part. And so there are instances where a system that produces stable stratification near its base can still go to a system that's mixed at time zero. This all depends on aspects of the phase diagram we don't know. So what's my message? My message is we simply don't know whether the Earth started out as a stably stratified system. But it's possible, it's also possible that it did not. Another thing to keep in mind about initial conditions is the core superheat. The core is substantially hotter right now than it would be if you took material from the molten state of the core-forming alloy in the upper mantle and just translated it along an adiabat to the core, which is what this line represents. So this is the present mantle and core temperature profile. This is the adiabatic compression starting from a state that is appropriate if you were trying to make a liquid alloy at low pressure. And the actual core is hotter than that, and the early core is surely hotter still. This difference might be as much as 2,000 degrees. That's what I mean by the core superheat. And that's important because it may play a role in determining how the core evolves through time. It's also diagnostic of the core formation process, but that's not the topic I want to cover. So let's go back now with that background about initial conditions and general principles and talk about process. What processes might be relevant? The first and most obvious point, of course, is that if you really did have a brick wall at the Coromandel boundary, liquid below, entirely solid above, then the extent to which the core influences the mantle is small if you are relying on solid-state diffusion, because even at those temperatures, solid-state diffusion is very, very slow. And so you don't expect to have a substantial effect of the core on the mantle if that is your process. Now, there is the possibility, of course, of diffusing some rapidly diffusing things, and hydrogen and helium might be exceptions. There may be important exceptions. Those would be the two that come to my mind. There might be others, but those would be the two most obvious ones. If you had those elements present, they might be able to diffuse a significant distance even if the bottommost mantle were entirely solid. Another process that is unimportant in most cases is capillary action. If you make a microscopic crack along grain boundaries, the liquid, of course, will rise up and form a meniscus, and you can do work against gravity in that way, but it only acts over distances of tens of meters or less. Another process that would be unimportant is convective entrainment. You have the large-scale circulation of the mantle. If the liquid in the core had a similar viscosity, you could actually entrain it, but because of the enormous rheological contrast, you don't get direct entrainment. Now, let me be clear what I'm getting at here. By direct, I mean low viscosity liquid, very high viscosity mantle. If, of course, some of the liquid from the core can get into the mantle, then it can be entrained, because then the entrainment process takes along the liquid that is at the grain-grain boundaries in the mantle. That would be a different process and possibly quite important. So let's talk about the important processes. These are the ones I'm going to say a little bit about each. First, I think it's possible that the core fluid can flow into the mantle sideways, so to speak, in the presence of topography, and I'll explain that. It comes about through suction. The mantle can suck liquid from the core into the lowermost mantle. And that's because the mantle is convecting and has deviatoric stresses of tens of bars. That will be enough, provided there are percolated pathways for the iron. Another possibility, of course, is that you have the partial melting that Thorne talked about, the ultra-low velocity zone, because of a constituent in the core. So maybe the core is playing a role. Maybe it's not just a coincidence that the ultra-low velocity zone is at the core mantle boundary. Of course, that's also the hottest place, so it's not an unreasonable thing to do. But maybe the core is playing a direct role. One example of how that would happen is by hydrous melting. That is, by the presence of hydrogen lowering the melting point of the lowermost mantle so that the lowermost mantle actually starts to melt. Another process is, instead of using capillary action, you use chemical potential differences. In other words, you say, okay, the core and the mantle are out of equilibrium, so you actually want to drive material up into the mantle from the core along liquid pathways using diffusion in the liquid phase. This is stronger than capillary action, although you still are working against gravity. Another process is underplating of the core mantle boundary driven by supersaturation of the core. The core started hot, it has cooled substantially, probably by more than 1,000 degrees, and it's entirely reasonable, in my opinion, that the core will supersaturate in one or more of the constituents that are present in the core and can form mantle phases, and so they will come out of the core. Another possibility is that you can redistribute material along the core mantle boundary. This is not a net flux issue, but a redistribution issue. You can move material from one part of the core mantle boundary to the other by flow along the core mantle boundary in the core, but carrying mantle material. I'll tell you a little bit about each of these.
Now, what about erosion and actually physically?
Yeah, erosion is the counterexample to supersaturation. And yes, that's also possible. So you're right, I did not, I thought of that as being of the same character as supersaturation, but yes, you could have that as well. I should say, one of the reasons I don't like that, apart from the reason I've already given about the history of the system, one of the reasons I don't like about that is that that makes the core energy problem even worse. Because then the core has to do work to get rid of that. You can't build it up as a liquid layer, for example. You can't have liquid accumulate at the core mantle boundary. You would have seen that. I'm talking about mantle liquid as a macroscopically thick layer. Therefore, you have to transport it down. That would be true with erosion as well. And then, of course, you have to do work against gravity because you're taking a light thing down. Let me also point out that erosion has another problem, which is the same issue that arises when you ask, why is aluminum metal stable in this room? The answer is it forms an oxide layer which protects additional chemical reaction. In the same sense, if I try to erode the metal using the core, not everything will be equally soluble. So you will leave behind a residue that will tend to protect the rest. So that process tends to be self-sealing. But I don't know for sure any of these things.
I'm thinking of temporarily removing some of the silicate and having small pieces interact. Come right back, Governor.
Yep. You might be able to do it as a cycle. Yes. In fact, I think that's a perfectly reasonable possibility. So here's the idea about suction of core fluid into the mantle. There must be topography at the core mantle boundary, just as there is dynamic topography at the Earth's surface. Mantle convection does that for you. It could also, of course, be isostatic topography, but that's not what I'm appealing to. Isostatic is like icebergs, and there you don't need a continuous deviatoric stress. But here, if you have a mantle circulation, this length scale here is thousands of kilometers, you have a mantle circulation which is of that kind, then of course if you look at the equilibrium of normal stress at this interface, which must be satisfied, then what you will find is that because of the term in the stress tensor that comes from this flow, the pressure in the mantle immediately above the core mantle boundary is lower than the pressure of the adjacent liquid at the same level. So the liquid will be driven in. That's what we mean by suction. And in this low mean stress region, the liquid ion will be sucked in, provided there are pathways. If there is also melting of the lowermost mantle, the pathways will be provided by that melt. In other words, you can have the liquid iron coexisting with the immiscible liquid silicate in the same pathways. This is well known, by the way, to people who study permeable systems in connection with getting oil out of the petroleum reservoirs near the Earth's surface. So there's nothing mysterious about that process. For deviatoric stresses of order 100 bars, which are not unreasonable as a consequence of the mantle convection, this region can be a few kilometers thick, comparable in general to the topography, although that of course depends on the viscosity structure of the mantle. Yes. Well, you know, one of the curious things about this, I'm actually working on this with a student right now, Ravi Kunda, who was here a couple of weeks ago, but not here now. If you write down the theory for this, what you find is that there's no obvious shutoff. That is, the system will keep trying to take iron in. And so, in principle, it can build up to 30% iron or something, at which point there's so much liquid in the lowermost mantle that it starts to lose its rheological character and might even approach a dense suspension. And then, of course, the whole mechanism breaks down because you don't have these large deviatoric stresses. So I have to say that I don't fully understand that, but it's certainly possible that you could diminish the seismic contrast and create a distinctively different character to that region. Percolation, of course, depends on interconnection, and we don't know whether iron interconnects. Iron has high surface tension, so perhaps it's not very good at interconnecting. On the other hand, the work of Dave Kolstad and his colleagues show that interconnection can exist. In fact, they've used this as an argument for using percolation as one of the mechanisms for core formation. These are experiments in which this is liquid iron in the presence of olivine, and under stress, under continuous straining, strain rate, you do get interconnection, not in the classic manner of tubules, but in the form of sheets, and so maybe you do get percolation being possible in a system like this. Moving on to the next process, I wanted to say something quickly about, and that is partial melting. I kind of like the idea of using hydrogen from the core. Now, of course, we again, as always in this problem, we don't know the phase diagram, so we don't even know for sure what hydrogen does to the minerals in the lowermost mantle. But let me just make the observation that when the Earth formed, there was, in all likelihood, an amount of water in the magma ocean that exceeded, perhaps by as much as an order of magnitude, the water that we know about in the Earth's hydrosphere. Some of that water is still present in the mantle, of course, of order an ocean, maybe several oceans worth. And we suspect that in the early history of the Earth, it lost water to space by hydrogen leaving hydrodynamically. So if you had a scenario, it's only one of several possibilities, but if you had a scenario where you partitioned hydrogen between iron at high pressure and the magma ocean, and we know that hydrogen goes into iron at high pressure, that's not in dispute, then subsequently lost hydrogen from the mantle, then there will be a natural tendency for the hydrogen fugacity of the core to be higher than the mantle and a natural tendency for hydrogen to leave the core. And so in that picture, one could, for example, have a dry solid that's sitting up here. Yes, it may well be a eutectic system, but we don't know whether the dry solidus is above or below the actual geotherm. And here is shown the geotherm with the increase in the region D double prime. And if the wet solidus was significantly lower than the dry solidus, then the ultra-low velocity zone could arise through hydrous melting.
Is it obvious from first principles that at high pressure the wet solidus is substantially lower than the dry solidus?
No, it's not. If you thought that that hydrogen were indeed favorably incorporated in the liquid, then of course at the limit of very low concentration there is the usual thermodynamic expectation that the presence of a minor constituent will lower the melting point. But of course water has a very special role in silicates at low pressure. That's much more than just that effect. So I don't think we know whether this is guaranteed.
With the presence of melting, it itself influence the diffusion of hydrogen out? Would it kind of run
yeah.
out locally, or would it be
difficult? Well, for example, suppose it were the case that the melt you made were less dense and actually rose and then refreezed. Then that would be taking material away and allowing more hydrogen to escape by lowering the abundance of hydrogen near the core mantle boundary. So that would be an example of a convective process that would favor more coming out. But the dynamics of this are frankly mysterious to me. I don't know how such a system would really operate. The possibility that the temperature drop crosses the dry solidus is still there as an option. I'm not saying that doesn't happen. I've always been a little bit uncomfortable with that hypothesis for the elementary reason that it looked to me like special pleading. Yes, I know the temperature increases a lot as you approach the core mantle boundary, and so it's not that unreasonable that it would cross the dry solidus, but the fact remains that what you are requiring in that instance is a little bit of a coincidence, that it just so happens that the geotherm crosses the dry solidus near the core mantle boundary. Now, there's another well-known coincidence in the way that the Earth operates, but I don't think it is a coincidence, and that is that you get melting under mid-ocean ridges. Which in the way we normally think about mantle convection is not guaranteed at all. In that case, it's probably not a coincidence because plate tectonics probably depends on that near-surface melting in order to create the character of the plates and the asthenosphere. So there may be something about the dynamics of D double prime that also locks the system in so that the actual temperature profile really does cross the dry solidus. That's a possibility. Or maybe it is just a coincidence.
Aren't there calculations or experiments that say that melting of walls of lower mantle materials is within 1,000 degrees of them?
Yes, within 1,000 degrees, yes. But then you have to ask, why is it that the ultra-low velocity zone is so thin? You have to think through whether you are requiring that the crossover be at 10 kilometers or 50 kilometers or 100 kilometers, and if you require that it be very close to the actual core mantle boundary, then that does become a coincidence.
So I presume that you're going to make an argument where that ultra-low velocity zone has to be something with iron, molten iron?
Actually, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that in the case of this particular picture, it would actually be mantle that is melting using hydrogen coming from the core and no role for iron directly at all. There will be some role, of course, for iron, because once you get the melt, you have the opportunity of rapid diffusion in those melt channels. And so then you can have diffusivities of 10 to the minus 4 centimeters squared per second instead of 10 to the minus 15. So then, of course, iron can play a role as well, and so I don't know whether this liquid is more or less dense, and so on and so forth. So we've already talked about that. There is a possibility of etching, that is by saying that because this material is out of equilibrium with the core and wants to melt, if I make any pathway at all, then remembering that diffusion to drive a chemical reaction is driven by chemical potential gradients, not just compositional gradients, chemical potential gradients, then there will be a tendency to have a reaction go as far as it possibly can, making use of any pathways that are available. And that's what I would call a grain boundary wetting process driven by disequilibrium, chemical disequilibrium. It's just like the capillary effect, except you're using the chemical potential difference instead of the rather tiny surface energy difference. What about underplating of the core mantle boundary? Well, I've made the point that I think the core cools through geologic time. So here's a core adiabat in an early epoch. Temperature is a function of depth into the core. And here's a core adiabat at some later point. And here's a hypothetical saturation curve for some constituent in the core, which is not necessarily a major constituent of the core, but will be there because the core formed through a process that involved equilibration between core and the mantle at high temperatures and possibly high pressure, at least in part. In this hypothetical case, which is just one of many, I don't know which one is correct, you would actually have a crossover of the adiabat with the saturation curve, so this region would become supersaturated and would in fact form a wet adiabat. That is, the core would then be in a state where there were particles of the mantle material actually freezing out, you know, just like raindrops or ice flakes in the Earth's atmosphere, and then would rain upwards to the core mantle boundary. There are also scenarios, depending on the nature of these curves, where the freezing is directly onto the core mantle boundary. Very briefly, the energy released by this process can be important. You can write down a formula for the rate at which energy is released by this process of taking material out of the core. If you say that the solubility scales is exponential of minus some enthalpy associated with this reaction that produces a separate phase, in general, it will have a form like this. For a solubility of this form, you can then calculate the total change over geologic time in the composition of the core in relationship to the extent to which the core has cooled. And there are several regimes depending on the ratio of the enthalpy associated with this supersaturation and KT. Delta H upon KT less than 1 is a case where the material is very soluble. That's also the case where this is least likely to happen. Delta H upon KT of a few means limited solubility, supersaturation is plausible, you get quite a large energy release. In this case, where delta H upon KT is much greater than 1, you have very limited solubility, but also there's not much material to come out, and so you don't get much energy release. And so the most interesting regime is actually in this region of delta H upon KT, and the vertical axis here is very interesting. This is a digression from the main purpose of this workshop, but as was mentioned yesterday, there is this issue of the core energy budget. Some people think you need more energy, and they've grabbed hold of K40 for some reason as an attractive alternative. Actually, there's a whole bunch of alternatives. I'm not saying that potassium is not there. I'm just saying that that's the one that people have grabbed hold of most quickly as an alternative energy source for the core. But you can also get an energy source for the core by supersaturation. And here's the energy released by the process I'm describing in units of what you get from growth of the inner core. So this is at least as important as growth of the inner core. And let me put it very concretely for you. The gravitational energy released from growth of the inner core, with half of the density difference between the inner core and outer core being intrinsic in origin and the other half being due to freezing, the 1220 kilometer inner core is energetically equivalent to the upward displacement out of the core of material that is half the density of the core, typical of mantle materials, with a layer only 10 kilometers thick. So if I interplate the mantle with a layer 10 kilometers thick of light star, I will get as much bang in terms of energy as the growth of the inner core. So that can be important for the dynamo. Briefly, there is also the interesting fact that if I have topography at the core mantle boundary, then because the solubility of the mantle in the core is pressure dependent, there will be a tendency for differential erosion and deposition. One of the two possibilities is that you have net dissolving of the mantle into the core at this location and net deposition over here. That would be the case where the solubility goes up with pressure, which is common but not always true. You then carry the material by a boundary layer, that is an orographic flow. It's not that much different from the katabatic winds that flow off the high topography of Antarctica towards the coast of Antarctica. You have a boundary layer flow that carries that material, and then you get deposition over here. There can be particles here, or it can just be a higher abundance of the light material. This is actually surprisingly efficient. You can transport kilometers, that is, you can dissolve away kilometers of this in 10 million years and deposit over here. The net effect, of course, is just to somewhat subdue the topography. If you believe the topography is caused by mantle convection will continuously recreate it. If you thought that the topography was purely isostatic, this would make the core mantle boundary flat. I should mention that the other alternative is, of course, that you grow the topography where it's already there and make the valleys even steeper. And there, too, the mantle convection will work to compensate that stalactites.
Does this increase the ability to entrain core into the material?
Yeah, it may, yes. Yeah, that's still a possibility. There isn't a lot of information content on this slide except to make the point that in principle you can affect many kilometers worth of the lowermost mantle and an equivalent volume of the core, assuming the core is well mixed. We don't know that, by the way. I mean, the topmost core could have a layer that has a stable stratification. But anyway, this is the kind of influence that you can get from these various processes. And a reminder, we don't know for sure that any of these processes actually exist. So let me finish. There are several different processes for transport across the core mantle boundary. Any one of the half dozen that I talked about can have important consequences over geologic time. We're not sure that any of them are important. I want to make that clear. I'm not sure. I find it unlikely that they're all unimportant. You can affect a substantial amount of the mantle, tens to hundreds of kilometers, so in principle, if you insisted, one could probably come up with a model that explained D double prime through this method. And of course, the extent to which the geochemical reservoirs have been influenced depend on the extent to which this layer has been sampled by large-scale mantle circulation or plumes. which is also not well known. So this is actually my last slide. My usual request for things that people should do, they're kind of obvious. I would put mineral physics number one. We're going to hear a lot more about that. I haven't talked about phase transitions. Clearly, we want to understand what the phase equilibria are in this part of the Earth, all of the lower mantle, obviously, 25 GPA up to 150. So we need to know about the phase diagrams, we need to know about the melting, the character of the melting, we need to know the liquidus phase, we need to know whether something that melts in the lower mantle goes up or down, the usual obvious questions, the partitioning, of course. And Thorne, of course, has talked about the characterization of the seismic structure, and I must say, as a somewhat peripheral worker in this field, I have been struck by how much more we know than we knew 20 years ago. It really has been an extraordinary amount of work, effort, interest, accomplishment in this field. But of course, it's not finished. The multiple scale question is very important. One would like to know all scales that are accessible to seismology. One would like to know the topography better. Want to know about the geochemical evidence for or against the role of the core. There is not much on that. I haven't talked about the osmium issue. Perhaps if Don brings that up, I'll make a comment about that. To me, using the inner core as a lever for that doesn't make sense, but indeed, some people have argued that perhaps there is some evidence for transport. And of course, there are a lot of dynamical questions, fluid dynamical questions, about the consequences of the processes I've told you about that need to be tested against the data. And I'll stop there.
Yeah. That the core mantle boundary might be seismically sharp but fuzzy, mostly solid above, mostly fluid below, and could be even a slurry below and still act like a fluid. The inner core outer core boundary is the same situation. It might be mostly fluid above and mostly solid below. And is it possible that, in fact, the whole outer core is a slurry and that you maintain this slurry because the particles are so small or the density difference is so low, or you melt and refreeze, or you supersaturate and under-supersaturate in the course of convecting the core? Or do you think that any particle has to grow so rapidly it's got to end up very quickly at the bottom of the mantle or the top of the inner core?
Well, Slava should probably answer this question, but I'll give you my brief summary answer first, and that is that for most reasonable parameter choices, it's difficult to maintain a really thick two-phase region. There's a tendency for crystals to grow quickly enough relative to the other timescales in the system that they will reach the point where they can separate gravitationally. Now, of course, there's lots of parameters in this problem, and I'm assuming that there's a significant density difference, as you would expect there should be, between the solid and the liquid. But the separation tends to be fairly efficient. The thing that Bruce Buffett and Raymond Jeanlot looked at, where they had a layer with the iron inside, liquid iron, as part of the layer that comes out of the core. In my opinion, that model is actually somewhat unreasonable because they are assuming that the viscosity, the compaction viscosity of the solid matrix is very high. For reasonable choices of that viscosity, you also tend to squeeze the liquid out. So the iron is, so I'm saying two different things. I'm saying in the suspension regime, you tend to keep those two-phase regions fairly thin. And in the compaction regime, where you do actually have some rigidity, the iron is very mobile and the compaction is geologically fast, just as it is between underneath mid-ocean ridges, by the way. So yes, you have these layers, but no, they're not 1,000 kilometers thick.
10?
10, yes.
100?
What do you think, Slava?
I think much less than that.
All right.
Chair, I have a question about this centrolimitous land, the formatal boundary, which is, you said that you might generate a similar amount of energy as the rotational. This should be an endogenic process, is it right? It consumes energy, right?
You're asking about the thermodynamics. I was only keeping track of the gravitational energy. The thermodynamic budget for that is not obvious. It depends on the entropy of the phases. But if you're saying, could the latent heat effect be important, the answer is yes. It will be important, and it may even work against. It doesn't have to, but it may work against it, yes. Stan?
You mentioned that local equilibrium seemed inevitable given the high temperature. But is there any, there's no experimental guidance. Is there any theoretical guidance for activation volumes and knowing what the most important temperature is?
I guess the answer is no. I mean, the people who do diamond cell work, of course, often they have quite extreme disequilibrium conditions anyway. When there is a reaction at all, it seems to happen on laboratory timescales, which is short. But from a theoretical standpoint, I guess you can't say with certainty.
In a sense, the same applies to your statement that hydrogen and helium are in the core and be a source. But that also depends on, I mean, our intuition is that they diffuse rapidly, but my intuition doesn't work at 135.
Well, I mean, I would hesitate to convert what I'm about to say into any kind of rigorous argument, but the fact remains that 4,000 Kelvin, typical estimate of the core matter boundary, is 1/3 of an electron volt. KT is 1/3 of an electron volt. And that's, from the point of view of typical energies for activation barriers and so forth, which might be several electron volts, that means you've got exponential factors that could be exponential minus 10 or 15 or so, but in front of that you're multiplying it by a rate coefficient that corresponds to time scales of 10 to the minus 10 seconds or something. So it's a little, when I go through that kind of reasoning, I can easily understand why diamonds in this room don't convert into graphite, but the corresponding thing at the core mantle boundary is hard to believe, of something sitting there in disequilibrium for long time scales. But it's not a rigorous argument, it's just a plausibility argument.
The gravitational energy for inner core growth is an important part of the energy budget. Latent heat is also important. It's somewhat less important, but not by a big bang. But you have to distinguish between two different issues. One is the energy budget for the dynamo, and the other is the heat flow through the core. And those things are related, of course, but one of the issues for the core is whether you've got enough heat flow to drive convection at all, or whether you can carry the heat by conduction. So that's why the latent heat is important. way that's different from just the energy budget that comes from potential energy.